Senate Committee on Judiciary is having a hearing on Wednesday, April 13th, 1983, 5 p.m. in Hearing Room A.
I have remonstrated to the President about these conflicting committee meetings, and a week ago he assured me that he would do something about that to stop this from happening, because this is our regularly scheduled time since the beginning of the session, and Energy and Environment is scheduled to overlap us right now, and Human Resources is scheduled to interfere at 7, because we really can't plan on Judiciary Committee meetings getting over in 2 hours with the number of bills we have in the committee, unless we want to take a position as a committee we're going to disregard a large number of bills that have been sent to the committee. And we just had a scheduling meeting this afternoon and scheduled a lot more work for the next 2 weeks. We are getting through our work, but it's only can be done with an awful lot of time. So I went and complained again today, and I hope we'll get some relief in that area. It's something that didn't happen last session because it was not allowed. Is Senator, Representative Farmer here? Is anyone else here who wanted to testify on? I agreed to let Representative Farmer testify on Senate Bill 285. She isn't here yet. Pardon me? Excuse me, 410, Senate Bill 410. Bob Watson has come today, the director of the Corrections Division, to talk with us about the prison impact of the bills that we heard last Thursday, most of which are on work session again today. Mr. Watson, Bob Watson.
Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bob Watson, Administrator of the Corrections Division. I'd like to start out by saying that we don't appear on these bills in opposition or support based upon their effect on prison crowding, and have, as a matter of policy, have not done that. We think that the merits of the bill ought to be considered free of that implication. However, the committee also should know that at the request of the Executive Department, Budget and Management Division, on every bill we do prepare an impact statement, and regrettably we have not made those available to this committee. I just found out prior to this hearing that the request had somehow or another got lost. We do send those routinely on every bill that's printed and distributed and have those statements available. With that in mind, when the chairman called me, I did find the three that relate to the Senate Bill 483, Senate Bill 713, and Senate Bill 410, and I could summarize it very quickly by saying there's very negligible impact from the standpoint of any space implication from the Corrections Division assessment of the these new changes in the statutes. Near as we can tell on Senate Bill 483, there may be maybe an effective 5 to 10 added inmates as a result of that change. And that's difficult to look into the future and see what these changes may result in the way of commitments, but by taking a percentage of the current arrests for sex offenses and making a projection based on what we think the effect would be in terms of inmates committed, it's a very small number.
Would that be 5 or 5 to 10 and over what time period?
Well, 5 we think in the next biennium and 10 in the following, so it's a very minimal impact. And again, Mr. Chairman, it's a projection of the group that falls into other sex offenses that is now reported in the crime statistics, so it's an assumption of about 1% of those other sex offenses would fit this category. On Senate Bill 713, which also relates to sex crimes, we don't think there's any net change in the number of prison bed spaces. The reason for that is very simple. The current law governing prison terms is driven by the parole matrix, which relates more to the criminal history of the individual. And since this is already a crime, changing that sentence may have some intangible effect upon the parole board's behavior, but it isn't. We didn't make that assumption and see no effect at all.
Which one is that?
Senate Bill 713.
Well, doesn't 713 make some things a Class A felony that aren't now? Some behaviors are Class A felony that aren't now?
I think that Senate Bill 483 does that. Excuse me.
I think 713 does too. Well, go ahead. 410,
Mr. Chairman.
A little hard to tell with a blank in it, isn't it?
We think that's about half the impact of the first bill, maybe 5 or 6 per year change in the number of individuals that we would have in prison. We think it has the bill itself has merit. We just think that there's a difficult thing for us to attribute to current arrests, what change may occur by a change in age, as well as the how many of the current other sex offenses would fit this definition. We just can't tell.
If we changed it, the behavior that's now a Class C felony made it a B. They've taken the C out and put a blank in with the implication that there's an interest in our raising that to a B or an A. Would that have an effect by lengthening the term of? That would change the matrix, wouldn't it, if you made it a B rather than
a C? No, Mr. Chairman, because the parole matrix has quite a mix. If you go down through the categories of crimes, and there are some C felonies that are high in that listing, and there are some Bs that are low. So they are not constrained by A, B, and C definition. The Commission on Prison Terms and Parole Standards has published that list. And there is quite a variation from the A, B, and C definition. And they're above and below one another. And they also have subcategories where violence is used or where it's a vulnerable victim and that sort of thing that will make a C felony maybe higher than a B and be grouped with A felony. So given that process that the commission uses in ranking crimes, I doubt if it would affect it. Shifting it from a B to a C or a C to a B. I just don't think it would.
If you hold everything else unchanged and just change the crime from a C to a B, it doesn't of itself change the matrix.
Well, there is, Mr. Chairman, there is a message there, of course, for the commission when the legislature does that you view it as a more serious crime, and it may, but it has not in the past, and because of that track record of the commission, we did not project a change in how they would behave with regard to this crime.
This is the document you were saying that you would need to look at to talk about what the legislature has done in the last since 73 in terms of. I asked him to comment generally about what the legislature has done in terms of changing crime classifications or making new crimes since in the last several years in terms of the impact that's had on the prison population, as so we could get sort of a general idea of what's been going on.
Mr. Chairman, this blue report is titled Crowding in Oregon Prisons, and there are three parts to it. In part one, there is a table that's titled Inmate Population and Legislative Changes, and it's pages 21 through 25, which goes back to 1971 and lists every change made through the 1981 session of the legislature, 11 years of changes, which had the effect of raising or lowering, adding or changing the penalties, depending on the any action by the legislature. Then there's a 3 pages of footnotes explaining which way you went on each new crime or change in penalty for an offense. And then we broke down the population of the total system on January 26, 1983, and spread them across all these penalties. And there are quite a number that, driving, for instance, we had 110 people, which was a change in the legislature in 1977. We've got it broken down so you can examine the number of people that are in the prison and when that legislation was enacted, just to give you a feel for the effect of the legislation as it occurs. And of course, in 1971, there was a total look at all the statutes. And what this does not show, and I don't know that I can ever break it out, is the net effect, because many of these things, just as some of the bills you're looking at today, were previously crimes, and you may have moved it from a B to a C or a B to a A, or changed the sentence from 5 to 10 because of that. It's almost impossible for us to say that created X number of more prisoners in the system. But it's pointed out not for the purpose of putting a damper on changes, because I think that's important to do. As times change and as behavior changes, you need to redefine crime. But the purpose of this and the Crowding Report is just to show the cumulative effect of all this over the 1971 through 1981 sessions. And there's a considerable effect from redefinitions of crime and new crimes that were added. And we think it's in the neighborhood of the equivalent of a couple of prisons is the net effect of all those changes in 12 years or 11 years. And I'm not saying that's bad. I'm just saying that society changes. The legislatures look to behavior and define new crimes and added penalties, and that's the net result. So if that's the that is good public policy, and I don't argue with any of these changes. I'm just pointing out that the effect of that is, at some point, we need more space, and that's why it's in this report.
Well, my number one goal this session for this committee, for myself, what I would add to this committee would be a bringing together of the corrections at the total system into more of a system that is where the public policy is articulated, where the causes and effects are thought through, and what's going on right now is the corrections division is going to Ways and Means and pointing out that they've got a crisis in the penitentiary. And the governor, of course, has money in the budget. Last session, the question of bed space was addressed through the substantive committees and Ways and Means, partly because there was a ballot measure for prison bonding. There appears at this moment to be more of a bifurcation this session, a step backward. So my number one goal is not only not coming to pass so far, we seem to be worse off. That doesn't discourage me. I'm determined to fight harder, and I am talking with members of Ways and Means, as I hope all of you are, to find ways to so we can work, participate with each other on this. I think in adversity, there's probably more opportunity sometimes to work together. But last Thursday, when we had the hearing, and four out of the five bills we had up had at least potential impacts of increasing the bed space, right at a time when there's the overcrowding is worse, much worse than it was at the time that the federal court decision came down in 1980, kind of rattled my bones. And that's why I decided to ask Bob Watson to come and talk with us. And the letter we sent out was sent March 8th, and I guess it got March 7th. I guess it kind of got in the wrong in-basket or something, and so Bob was willing to come. And we're going to be able to get these as a regular course now. When the bill is coming up for hearing, we'll get and we'll provide all of you copies of the projected impacts. But I think we ought to consider, and I don't think we ought to try and make a decision about it right now, but I think we ought to consider making some kind of an agreement among ourselves what we're going to do this session, at least on this one question of enhancing penalties. Should we say that if we're going to enhance a penalty, we're going to point to some other penalty that's going to be de-enhanced? I don't know what the antonym of enhance is, but it seems to me that it's downright dangerous right now to do anything that's going to send more people into a system that's where last session Bob Watson was telling us we got a problem and it's getting worse. This session, I see downright alarm after the defeat of the ballot measure. And although these bills we heard the other day, we're hearing now that they might have 5 to 10, but you know that saying about a million here, a million there, it adds up. And I'm sorry that your bill isn't rescheduled today, Senator Brown, and partly because I want to hold it out for the same critical examination. But it was totally inadvertent we didn't get it on.
Chris, Senator Gardner. My suggestion would be we approach this much as we approach a budgetary matter. And we have a limited space to budget. And basically we try to project what reasonable amount of spaces are going to be, and that we tote up the bills with their impact statements, which you will do, right? I mean, you will prepare those as impact statements, and we try to balance our budget. I think that's the responsible way to approach it. And maybe find other alternatives. For instance, in the DUAL situation, there are some attractive alternatives there.
Yes, I think we're on a good route in that area.
Yeah.
We aren't proposing we make it a felony.
Non-incarceration alternatives that are significant punishment.
One of the things that Bob Watson has told me is that they've looked at the prison population and the crimes and have identified several discrete areas where if you made things that are Class C felonies, Class A misdemeanors, it would have a significant impact. But you have to impact, I think he said something like 8, or maybe he didn't give a number, but it's a large number of separate penalty crimes in order to have a significant impact. And that requires you to push through this political process.
Like you're getting soft on crime.
Each one of which can be attacked as being soft on crime. And so if you lose half of them, you go through all the effort and political exposure and come up without very much.
The other alternative is to roll them all. Roll them all into one big bill, so that you would have the bills that and it would be in the nature of a sentencing reform package or something like that, where you'd have the bills reducing the proposed reduce the penalties in that bill, as well as maybe some of the enhancement ones in one bill,
mm-hmm.
so that part of it was tougher on crime and part of it was maybe softer. But as a whole, it's a more appropriate balance.
That might be a possibility. Yeah, mm-hmm. Senator
Chairman. Yes, I think your remarks, Mr. Chairman, are very well taken, and Senator Gardner's suggestion of looking at this thing in terms of a package makes a lot of sense to me. And I'm wondering, in view of what both of you said there, and I don't know what this report is that Mr. Watson has, but I'd be interested in looking
at it. We'll get you a copy immediately.
I'm wondering if...
I thought we each had one. I'm sorry.
I'm wondering, Mr. Chairman, if these problems, which I think are critical, as the Chairman has pointed out, shouldn't be addressed in some interim study and come up with a package, like Senator Gardner is suggesting, that covers There are people up there maybe that shouldn't be there, and maybe there are some sentences that I'm thinking, for example, of armed robbery, which used to carry a life sentence unless the judge saw fit to render a lesser sentence. But maybe there are some of those crimes where the penalty is probably not great enough. But look at the whole
sexual psychopaths, psychopaths that injure people terribly, and we've addressed that some in our aggravated murder statute, but they're.
In other words, the sentencing problem, it seems to me, is significant enough in the corrections problem that instead of going about this thing piecemeal, one bill here and one bill there, that we really ought to take a look at the whole picture. Mm-hmm.
There was an interim committee on sentencing, but that's one piece. And we are going to be getting some bills over from the House on that. But I agree with you. We tried to get at that in kind of a two-way thing during the interim. We had the interim Committee on Sentencing that drew in many excellent people like Judge Holly Peel, Mike Schrunk from DA from Multnomah County, and so forth. But we had a corrections subcommittee. If the ballot measure passed, we were going to really work with Bob Watson, the correction division, to try and be sure that was carried out in such a way to get the maximum amount from the money from the ballot measure. The ballot measure failed, and that pulled the rug out from that. Senator Brown.
I was going to ask Bob a question, and I was a little bit like cross-examining the witness without knowing the answer at your peril, because I'm concerned as to whether or not we achieve any deterrence from enhancing the felony level on a sex crime or crime of aggravated assault. Appreciating that in the final analysis, the sentence served is really determined elsewhere.
You mean you want to know if you can pass a bill that will tell all the seniors you've enhanced the crime that won't impact the prison population?
But enhances
is that your question, Senator?
Yeah, enhances some deterrence. I'm very serious about that.
That's the fundamental problem with the issues around sentencing. Is it going to achieve the result that the policymakers set out to achieve? And there have been studies on the extreme end of that, such as a death penalty for drug pushers in New York. And I'm not sure those really give you the answer to the question you're asking, and that is, with regard to all the people that go through the criminal justice system, what is the effect down the road? And that is a responsibility, I think, of all of us. And our study of that gets redefined every time we have a legislative session that changes things. So we don't have a good, clean track record back, and that's another thing that I think that shows up in here. But there is a lot of discretion in the system, and I think a fundamental question we ask is the use of probation a good buy for the taxpayers? And we can answer that one pretty well. But whether or not 4 years in or 5 years in or 2 years in is better than 10 years in is something that we just can't really analyze, because there's such a small number of people that it changes each interval that we look at.
But that was not quite the question. I've been pushing for some time, not without much success, for enhancing the penalties on aggravated assaults, senior assaults, sexual assaults on seniors. And I do appreciate that the time served may not change, but with the deterrence, substantially change. Because see, we've had an increase incident of aggravated assaults twofold and sexual assaults threefold in the 70s on the same population.
Senator Brown, I have some material that does study sentencing, not in Oregon, but in other jurisdictions, that may shed some light. I'd be happy to send it to you or to the committee. And I haven't looked at it from that standpoint, but there has been studies done to examine the question of deterrent effect by the published penalty.
Not even result in the served penalty.
Yeah, and I think that's true of some of the legislation that's been enacted by this legislature, because I look down through this list and there's quite a number we have no people. And someone argues, gee, that's really working. You know, you got the you've got the crime on the books and the penalty's there, and nobody commits that crime.
It's like the crumpled up newspaper and the elephant in the backyard.
Yeah, right.
It works.
Well, I believe there is a deterrent effect, but to measure it is really a problem.
Thank you. Sorry to hold that up.
Do you think there's a deterrent effect for there to be a law on the books that makes something a B felony instead of a C felony?
I don't know. I don't think that.
Because the bill that he's talking about is taking existing crimes, not adding any elements. It's not going to draw anybody new into the net, and add it, but adding, lifting them up one each step, step of assault, raising it, for example.
Well, if you'd ask me the question, do I think change in the penalty from 5 years to 10 years is there a deterrent effect, and I'd say yes, and I think that's probably what you're saying.
A deterrent
in the max on a B is twice what it is for a C.
Deterrent in the sense that the person may be in there longer and therefore not available to do it again, or do you mean that you think it's a deterrent because they hear about it?
Depends on how it's whether or not we prosecute them for it, whether or not they see people being sentenced for it. That's one of the effects, I think. Very difficult to measure.
Further questions? Thank you very much. We really appreciate your taking your time and getting us this information.
I'll leave these with that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Farmer, due to a mix-up last time where she was here waiting, and when we finally got around to calling her, she had to go back to committee, so I asked her to come back today on Senate Bill 410.
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you for letting me testify today. I'm sorry I missed it the other day. And members of the committee, I didn't want to miss, however, testifying on this bill because I feel very strongly about any issues concerning children. As you probably have heard, I have a bill against selling of children. I have a bill about
doing what to them?
Selling of children. A bill about surrogate parenting, which is also in a way for protection of the children as well as everyone else involved. And when I heard about this bill, well, it was actually Senator Wicker that asked me to be a co-signer. He knows how I feel about that. By the way, I am Annette Farmer, District 20 in East Multnomah County in Portland. I want to speak, of course, in favor of Senate Bill 410. This is because we need desperately statutes that will prohibit persons knowing, promoting sexual performances by children, distributing material which depicts such a performance, or employing children for sexual displays in films or slides. It is absolutely shocking to know that we have laws for protection of animals. And I believe in those laws. I don't want anybody to think that I am not for laws protecting animals. However, we do not have them for protection for exploitation of children. Thousands of adolescents run away from home every year. They learn to survive on the street, selling their bodies, stealing, seducing. Besides pimps, however, waiting at every bus and railroad station for those kids, there are others waiting that are offering money for posing in pictures, usually engaging in sexual acts with another child or adult. Perverted acts, of course, command more money. In some cases, children such as young as 5 years of age have been recruited for the job, sometimes with the parents' blessing. Now, I know that I read some time ago about a case in Long Island where somebody put an ad in the paper offering $200 for taking pictures of children in the nude, and there were over 200 parents that came with their children to take advantage of that offer. Sex clubs are springing everywhere, particularly in the large cities. And I'm sure you read about the one in Boston North American Man Boy Club that has a membership of 500 people.
What's that one?
It's abbreviated NAMBLA, North American Man Boy Association, or whatever it
means.
What's
its purpose? Or, I mean,
the purpose is actually not only engaging in sexual acts, boys and men, but also for others, for audience to watch while they're doing that. I read, as a matter of fact, in one of the English magazines that they're offering there, one of their pedophile magazines is offering a legislation, perhaps, something on that order. You know, they have different system to drop the age of consent to 5 years. 5 years of age. You know, consent between two adults, well, they want to drop it to 5 years of age. Yeah. Now, could you imagine something like that? Now, why are we talking about children when there are so many grown-ups that probably willingly will do this? The answer is that there is a
Mr. Sandrock's interpretation is right, or mine's right. It doesn't matter. We have no opposition if you would like to adopt her suggestion. I think it's a good one. We have serious, related to this mental state problem, is there's no definition of the word consent in the proposed bill. And I believe Senator Frey noted that last week. Now that causes serious problems, and I think maybe it gets to the heart of the matter. First of all, it does invite constitutional challenge. It may be unconstitutional, it may not be unconstitutional. A court would likely, in my opinion, write in some definition and hold it to be constitutional. But that shouldn't be what the legislature's goal is, and that shouldn't be left to the trial judge to have to guess at what it means. The jury guesses at what it means, and someday, maybe down the road, it's either thrown out or it's salvaged, and we start all over again. It would be much simpler just to determine whatever you want it to mean if you want to go this route and write it in. I think the lack of definition is very, very critical. The proponents last week suggested it would lead to uniformity, quite to the contrary. Without defining the word consent, what it does, and I suggest what really the undercurrent of the whole bill is it allows the state to convict the marginal bad guy in the close cases. Now, that may be something that you consider desirable. I suggest that it's not, that the balance between the rights of the accused and the rights of the victim, at least in the context of the criminal statutes, is currently wise. Maybe it needs some tinkering, such as Senator Cohen's suggestion, but it doesn't need what appears to be a subtle revamping, which could lead to a major change in what happens in the courtroom. If we leave it just the word consent, the juries may think it has to be the affirmative statement, please do not have intercourse with me, or whatever, which you were Senator Frey was noting last week. If we're going to do it this way, let's at least write what consent means. Now, I drafted a suggestion at the bottom of page one of my... That's just a place to start.
What would you think if we took off the second sentence of your suggestion?
Where do we find this letter?
Should be in your folder on 713.
What? I don't...
I had...
This stuff, dude.
Okay. I'm sorry, there are two sets of folders today, I believe. One on previous information submitted, and then the new information we've gotten since the hearing.
What's the second sentence doing in there?
Well, actually, I think that was intended to assist the victim in the situation where the circumstances were such it would be unreasonable to communicate it at all.
It must be manifested
by reasonable means under the totality of the circumstances. And as I said, this is just a starting point. The main point behind the idea is that the victim, must manifest her non-consent when it is reasonable to do so under the circumstances.
That's the difference. No, there you're switching around, though. See, if it's if you say consent means the complainant manifested approval of the sexual intercourse either expressly or impliedly. That means if approval was not given either expressly or impliedly, it's non-consensual. But it's different to say that the victim must manifest non-consent or must manifest refusal. Is there an affirmative obligation to refuse, in other words, on the part of the victim?
Yes, unless the circumstances are such that that affirmative manifestation is unreasonable. For example, the threat of violence.
And that's, I guess, where this maybe shifts the... Because I think if you just have your first sentence, I don't think there is that affirmative obligation.
I would hope that the committee would adopt both prongs of what I'm suggesting. This language is not necessarily artfully done.
No, but it gets at the issue, right, which is under the existing law, there, I guess, and that's your I find this terminology a little bit offensive myself. It's not your terminology, it's prerogative to kiss and right to slap. I guess it's a historical. But if there is now, and you're saying that there must be a communication and proof of a communication in the trial of non-consent.
Must prove that the defendant knew.
And yeah, the defendant, and that there was a manifestation. And I guess that's really the issue. That's where that kind of burden of proof, if you will, lies, and where it should lie.
I agree. That's one of the main issues, and I'm suggesting that you have to. The defendant must know that the person didn't consent, unless under the circumstances it would be unreasonable for her to manifest that. But you should focus on the defendant's state of mind, not the victim's actions. Again, it's the opposite of what was said last week. You have to focus on the defendant's state of mind. Obviously, the victim's actions are important, and they relate to that. But I would suggest conceptually you should focus on that.
Mr. Chairman? Senator Pryor.
Could I ask Mr. Letourneau if this language, I'm looking now at Senator Hendrickson's written testimony here. I want to know whether this language is given uniformly in the instructions in a rape case. You might not have it in front of you, but let me read it to you. That is where the judge defines forcible compulsion and defines it as physical force that overcomes earnest resistance or a threat expressed or implied that places a person in fear of immediate or future death or serious physical injury to self or another or in fear of immediate or future kidnapping. Is that usually what the court instructs the jury?
Yes, that is basically verbatim from the uniform jury instruction.
Okay, now from your own experience, and I assume that you've
tried
these cases.
Unfortunately, I've tried dozens of them.
From your own experience, sir, do you think that that instruction is workable, or would you say that juries end up thinking that the state hasn't? I want to say this right now. The concern has been expressed that unless we change this language around, that juries seem to put too much of a burden on the victim. And, of course, my own feeling is that that is not correct. And I'm wondering from your experience whether you think that sufficiently tells the jury what the threat is. In other words, whether that is sufficiently instructs the jury that there has to be shown a lack of consent.
My answer is yes. And I find the current definitions workable, and thus I don't find any reason to change them.
Now, probably if you try very many of these cases, once in a while somebody gets acquitted. That's bound to happen. And would you, in those cases, do you feel that the acquittal is due to the ineffectiveness of the law as written, or do you feel that those acquittals arise out of other factors that the jury has considered?
Well, I find it to be the latter now that we have a rape shield law. Before the rape shield law, I think that it was quite debatable. It probably erred on the side of favoring the defendant. But now the rape shield law has handled, as a practical matter, a good deal of the concerns. I can share with you our statistics on rape one in the first degree last year in Multnomah County.
Yes, you would.
They're not statistically significant because there are so few. 11 trials, and that would include both forcible and incestual rape ones. I assume they're all or almost all forcible rape in Multnomah County if they went to trial. 2 acquittals, 4 guilty to lesser, 5 guilty of the charge. I don't think that's significantly different than our trial rate in other types of major felonies. But again, 11 cases isn't all that significant. I found it interesting last week that I wrote down in my notes, Mr. Sandrock was testifying that they didn't really have any trouble proving consent. Now, when Senator Gardner, later on in the sessions, directly asked him, I think he modified his position on that. But I think the gist of what he was saying initially, at least, and you can read back what he said, was that they don't have a lot of trouble proving consent. What they need is corroboration to help make their case better. And to get corroboration, you need better police work, quicker reporting, better education of the police, better education of the victims, all the things that were alluded to, or some of the things that were alluded to by last week's witnesses, which I agree with totally. And if you could spend money to assist justice in the rape area, it'd be better spent on all those things, and therapy for the victims, and counseling for the offenders. But that's not before you. It's not relevant. It's not relevant to this technical change in the criminal law, which is the whole point. You can't accomplish those things by changing the law this way. This is purports to be a technical change in the criminal law. It's not going to reach those social reforms. It may lock up some people who shouldn't be locked up. And that's my major concern. By capturing the marginal people, the close cases will be easier for the state to prove if you don't define consent.
Who are those close cases? I mean, what kind of cases? I don't have a real good sense about what a close case is. What would be captured by the bill as drafted, let's say, and the existing law? Just on your own experience.
I'm not sure that I can answer that directly, but I'll share some information. Hopefully it'll be responsive.
Yeah.
A good defense case, or a tribal defense case, ones that we most often win, would be acquaintance to acquaintance, as opposed to stranger to stranger. There's no problem in prosecuting stranger to stranger rape cases, in my opinion. Defense tends to win more acquaintance to acquaintance, or someone's picked up at a bar, and I call that acquaintance to acquaintance. They've met at least for some time prior to the intercourse. There's usually no corroboration or no strong, believable corroboration. Now, if the person calls immediately after the report, and this in Multnomah County, this is taped, and it's recorded, and both sides have access to it, and they're hysterical, that's corroborating. It's still from the victim herself, but it's strong corroboration. I'm not saying that they call it art hysterical necessarily, but if you have that, then that really assists the state. But if you don't have it, or you don't have other forms of corroboration, such as good scientific tests, physical bruises, other witnesses, any sort of corroboration tends to put it in the strong state's case side. But if you don't have the corroboration, that's when you get in these close cases. Defendant says it was consensual. Victim says it wasn't consensual. The defense can win a fair share of the time. I'm concerned that if you make this subtle change in the law, and especially if you don't define the word consent, mm-hmm. you're going to be convicting more of these people. And I'm not sure I'm right, but that's my fear.
But won't you simply be arguing, I guess I'm having trouble seeing what really the difference will be. Aren't you going to be arguing in that case that it was consensual and trying to prove that it was consensual? So isn't that precisely what you're trying to prove now?
Well, if the word consent was defined adequately, it would take away much of our concern about the bill. Right now it's not defined. I suggest
yeah,
that's purposeful.
That.
Because if you don't define it, it lets the jury in an ad hoc manner, without even the definition of earnest resistance being read to them.
I can see your
point. I've got these bills broken up tonight about half the time in these criminal ones and half in civil. I can stay. Does anyone have to leave at 7?
I have another committee at 7.
Okay.
I'll stay and sit as a subcommittee.
Well, we got work session tonight, it's a thing.
We can't do much of that.
Yeah. We do need to have a subcommittee long enough for me to
run down the hall and write back.
We'll be adjourned for a minute.
You want to adjourn for a minute?
Yeah.
Okay. We do want to take Pete Sandrock very briefly, and then we want to go on to civil bills. Senator Thorne wants to testify on the court appeal bill. So we'll take you after just a short break. Or maybe we better take Pete Sandrock, and then we can now, and then we can change counsel and like a pit stop.
Been nice
pit stop. I hope that didn't make it sound like you two are interchangeable. You are. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The rest of what I had to say is basically covered in here, and I'd be happy to answer questions outside.
Okay. Pete Sandrock, very briefly. Because you testified last time on 483.
Thank you. For the record, Mr. Chairman, Pete Sandrock, Benton County District Attorney. I had a chance to talk with Mr. Letourneau outside for a brief period of time. I think he has some legitimate points, and I think there are some areas that we can, the proponents and opponents can reach a reasonable a set of accommodations here. It would have been my interpretation of the law all along, both statutorily and constitutionally, that the state would be required to prove each and every element of the offense, including that the defendant knew that the victim did not consent to the intercourse, regardless of whether we put any language in there that either suggests the victim must communicate her lack of consent or that the defendant must have understood under the totality of the circumstances that she was not consenting to this act. I don't have a strong feeling one way or another. This is the first opportunity I've had to examine Mr. Letourneau's letter.
Can you work with him on that and with the other proponents and get back to us?
I think we can do that.
Okay. So you can come up with a good compromise on that.
I think we can do that.
Okay. Chairman, Senator, I know that you're anxious to take this little recess, but while Mr. Sandrock is here, I would like to put something in the record because
sure.
If it's inaccurate, I want him to
sure.
respond to it.
Go ahead.
And this is partly in response to Senator Gardner's question about giving an example type thing. I read in the Oregon Inn over the weekend that the state of Oregon and Oregon State University have been sued for, I think, $300,000 by a male student who was arrested and charged through your office with sexual abuse and harassment because of the complaint of a female student who later recanted and said that she wasn't telling the whole truth. And he is now suing for whatever, because he got wrapped up in the system based strictly, apparently, on or substantially on what this woman said. It's also my understanding that about a year ago, your office dismissed a rape charge against another student when, again, the female complainant told your office that she hadn't been telling the whole truth to start with. Now, if those stories are true, and you can comment if you'd like, those are examples of how possible to get the innocent swept up in the criminal law system unless we're very careful in defining these elements and in placing the burden where the Constitution places it. Is that a fair statement, would you say, Mr. Sandrock? In substance, anyway?
I think that you're right, that we have to be very careful to protect the rights of everyone involved. In terms of the particular cases that you were referring to, the one out of which the lawsuit arises, there were two charged incidents, one in which the defendant was alleged to have had offensive physical contact with the victim, and on a separate occasion to have had sexual contact with the victim. The sexual contact allegation was an unwitnessed event. The harassment incident was a witnessed event. The defendant denied both. The victim later, in essence, recanted a substantial portion of her story as to the sexual abuse incident, although still claimed that there had been some contact. The other case that you're referring to, I don't know. From time to time, there are cases in which complaining witnesses withdraw and recant. The area in which that most frequently happens is with child victims and it is generally not because there are other areas in which we have so-called victims who recant with the arson victim, for example, is frequently a false victim. Robbery victims are, from time to time, false victims. The employee of the store who fakes a robbery to tap the till, for example.
The first case did involve universities. Apparently, you don't have any present recollection.
I don't recall what that one might have been.
Thank you. You want to make some comments at some point or another, I guess, on 483.
483, yes, Senator.
Could those go well when we come back to what you're ready to help us with on 713 later? Or do you want to do that now?
Really, I'm here to accommodate your needs, and if perhaps through a written submission at a later time or after having talked with Mr. Letourneau at greater length,
That would help me. We have several people here on the other bills.
Sure, I understand that.
Okay.
And we've discussed some possible technical changes in that bill, too.
Thank you very much. I think we'll take a five-minute recess. Committee on the Judiciary come to order. We're in subcommittee of Senator Frey, Gardner, and Wires, and we're expecting Senator Hanby back momentarily. She went upstairs to get a cup of coffee. Senator Thorne is here to talk with us about the appellate process in Oregon. Senator Thorne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I realize this is scheduled as a work session, so I came down to provide whatever I could to the Judiciary Committee, which may be very little. So I'm here at your disposal, if you will. I would like to call your attention to a rather interesting letter written to you as the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Senator Wires, which is a fairly comprehensive rebuttal of some of the statements made. I think both Judge Lent and Joseph, as well as the committee and Assistant Ms. Rogan, have a copy of the letter, I believe. So I just refer that to you. I think some of the points may be a bit humorous, but they certainly make the point.
Senator Gardner.
Do you have any problem with Bill Frey's amendment to include appeals from district courts?
No, I do not.
I also have two page threes, as does Senator Cohen and Frey on this letter.
Well, it may be that if you get through page three, you've probably gotten the gist of his letter, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Got that in the first paragraph, I think.
Counsel has prepared a mock-up here. Why don't you tell us, Counsel, what we've got here. She's also put a copy of a major cleanup bill from the House, that 2364, that has a relating clause that would permit us to consider putting it in there. I would really like to reserve a decision on that, which vehicle we would use, until I'd had a chance to do some talking with the other Judiciary Committee. Counsel?
Well, you should have, besides the letter from...
Excuse me, we got a power outage. I think he did this briefly once before. Well, we'll recess briefly.
I want to show you how things are going up home. They're plowing with mules again, if you want to see what's in the latest paper.
Oh, God.
Since you're recessing.
Oh, now we're committing.
Is that the energy crisis?
Is it okay?
Just done over the weekend.
Okay, we're in full committee session now with four members present. Senator Hamby is here. Counsel was about to tell us what's in our book here about Senate Bill 548.
Well, you should have, besides a letter from Gene Hallman, you should also have a letter from Judge Howell. You should have the fiscal analysis. There's also a letter from Milo Pope that all of those have come in from since the last hearing. You also have from the state court administrator her response to Senator Frey's request about the number of district court appeals from Eastern Oregon that were taken in 1982, showing that there were a total of 20 cases. The mock-up of the bill is only a conceptual mock-up, taking into account the amendments that were proposed at the hearing and also the amendment proposed since by Gene Hallman. I've also given you a copy of, briefly, the amendments were chief. Judge Joseph's position was that if we were going to do this at all, we should make it mandatory for all appeals that were east of the Cascades. Bill Gary, the Solicitor General, was suggesting that in any case where the state was a party, that we would not require these appeals to be held in Pendleton. Gene Hallman's letter affirmed Senator Frey's idea about including district court appeals and suggested that he agreed with Judge Joseph about exempting Deschutes County as well as Klamath and Lake. I talked to an attorney in Bend whose name escapes me. I talked to a number of them. He's the head of the Central Oregon Bar Association, and he told me that they had already taken a position supporting the bill without excluding Deschutes County. There is no Deschutes County Bar Association, so you can't get a more discreet idea of what just the lawyers in Deschutes County want, but that they're perfectly happy with the bill the way that it's proposed. And he felt if they didn't want to be heard in Pendleton, they would just try to stipulate to come to Salem. I also attached a copy of the current Rules of Appellate Procedure, which Rule 816 requires the Court of Appeals to go to Pendleton twice a year in civil cases, excuse me, and excludes criminal and state agency cases, and allows them to be set in Salem unless the court orders otherwise. The interesting.
Are you following that rule?
I gather not.
They're not, Betsy? Are they following that rule? Are they going to go twice a year for civil cases to Pendleton henceforth?
Well,
but it says twice a year in the rule. I'm having trouble understanding something. If this
if you
rule,
want to ask her another question, we better get her on.
Yeah, Betsy, could you come up to him? If the court intends to adhere to this rule, you know, Judge Joseph's comment was that there's just not enough cases to make up a docket there, basically.
Twice a year, he doesn't think, right?
But that's what the rule says now.
I understand.
And I assume they're not going to, those rules are binding on the court until altered. So, are they going to, are they intending to alter this rule?
I have not discussed that with him, but I will.
It's in effect now, though.
That's right. And as I said, the last time they went was spring of 82. They did not go in the fall of 82. And he told
so they did not follow the rule in 1982.
That's right. And my understanding was that there were not enough cases to go, and there is one case now. He said if they went right now, they'd have one case. I do remember him telling
yeah.
me that.
But the rule doesn't make that a condition.
I understand. I'm just saying I think that's the reason that they are not following the rule, but other than practicality.
Mm. How about if you added district court appeals to it also?
Well, there'd be 20, you know, there'd be 20 of those, so that would increase the number.
Well. Another problem with the Court of Appeals with this rule is that it does not include, it lists those counties the appeals from which will be heard in Pendleton. It doesn't include Deschutes County, Sherman, Crook, Hood, Jefferson, or Wasco.
Hood River, please.
So, Hood River, I'm sorry. The next thing is a little map that shows you which counties are excluded by the statute and which counties are excluded by the court rule as well.
And no, I cannot explain the difference.
Yeah.
I don't
so
know
they're
why.
Not including any appeals that may have been filed from those north central counties in the figures when he figures that there would have only been one appeal ready, I guess that, if you can follow that. Mm. Their rule doesn't include the same counties that the statute does.
The all yellow area is what?
The Klamath and Lake County at the bottom in stripes are the ones that have been excluded always from the statute. The Wasco, Jefferson, Deschutes, Crook, Sherman, and Hood River are counties that are not included in the court rule. The rule says all civil cases arising from the following counties will be set in Pendleton, and then it only lists those counties that are in white. Mm. So.
And the statute would cover all.
That's right.
All the counties east of the mountain.
That's right.
So we would probably need to ask a county like Hood River County whether they'd want to be in the bill or out of the bill.
I don't know which counties are members of the Central Oregon Bar Association, but counties that voted to support 548 would presumably be Deschutes,
Crook, and Jefferson. Believe, yeah.
Okay.
But the Hood River Bar Association, I know, has lunch together once every week. We could very quickly get their unanimous feedback. Or we could ask the presiding judge.
Get a list of from Mr. Olson of the bars and contact them. I don't know. I'm not sure there's one per county out there. Not just Crook and Jefferson, but I think there may be.
Of course,
I'm not sure
they
about
could,
email here.
Any cases that, I mean, I would think that lawyers would be able to stipulate to that very readily. If that's, you know.
Well, what happens if you have one lawyer from? I don't know what a Hood River lawyer would want to do if the lawyer was from on the other side of from Portland and they weren't stipulating. Whether they'd want a statute that could force it up to Pendleton or whether they would want one that would force it to Salem.
Well, closer to Portland. I mean, closer to Salem, isn't it? There.
Yeah, it is closer to Salem. It's about 2 hours from Portland to Salem, and it's about 2.5 to Pendleton, as I recall.
I was just going to say he's exceeding the speed limit.